for they shall see God.
Can I just take one lyric from one song, obviously, like one of the most famous in the early days, Suzanne. There's this one thing in that song where you say, only drowning men can see him. What do you mean? Are we supposed to take that literally, to say that that's when you see Jesus or something?
Well, Jesus himself said that. He said, blessed are the poor in heart, for they shall see God. In other words, we have this idea that, you know, that there's a triumphant position in life. You know, that we stand here as conquerors, that we claim the universe in some sort of way, but it just don't work that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only when your back's against the wall that you lift up your voice in prayer and supplication. It's only when your back's against the wall that you begin to consider, like, where you are and where you came from and where you're going.
What kind of a catharsis that you sort of experience when you finally get a body of work out, be it a book, I mean a novel or a book of poetry, or be it an album, that, for instance, like, if you write about love a lot of the time, and like, just take a song like There Ain't No Cure for Love or something, that it's some sort of a disease, that if you can get something written down about it and get into the inner sanctum of it or whatever, this inner struggle that you sort of write about a lot, that if you can get into that by getting it out, it's a sort of a, you know, on a higher plane than your man down the road.
Well, only in the sense of, you know, nobody can control their lives. You know, at least I'll speak for myself and a few people I know, but just for myself, you know, you kind of make a mess of your life. And, I mean, you do the best you can, but you can't really order it too militantly, you know. Things fall where they do. But your work is a different thing. You know, you can really work on your work. You can really organize it. You can really polish it. And in that sense, yeah, you can locate your self-respect in your work. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the actual significance of the work, I think it's beyond meaning and significance. And, you know, I use the metaphor of the diamond. I mean, like, what's a diamond for, you know? Well, all a diamond is something that's cut and polished and amplifies light. It doesn't have a meaning beyond that, you know. And that's the way I feel about my verses, you know. It's not about the meaning, you know. It's about the cutting and the polishing and the amplification of light.
The amplification of light, indeed. We're looking at Leonard Cohen.
Do you think in some ways that it was good for you as a person, just developing as a person and as a writer, to be so late coming into what we will call for the moment the rock and roll world?
Well, that's what they say, you know. You can never tell how anything's going to affect you. It's hard to speak from any point of view but experience. But I've seen what early fame and fortune do to a number of people. And it seems to wreck them pretty badly. It seems to push them around pretty badly. It seems to give them a kind of odd view of things. You know, it wasn't until I was 35 that I actually began to make any money at anything connected with, you know, my writing or my singing.
You actually went to Nashville, or like, having been a writer, having had books of poetry, having had novels out, you went to Nashville to become what exactly?
Well, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to become, but I know that I had to do something. You know, I'd published a couple of novels and a number of collections of poetry, and I couldn't make a living. I'd gotten glorious reviews, you know, from the New York Times and all over the place. In fact, I was hailed as, in fact, somebody said, you know, I think it was a Boston something or other, said, you know, that James Joyce is not dead, he's alive and well and working in Montreal. I mean, they were really glorious reviews, and I couldn't pay any bills.
Ronnie Spector on the program some time back, and she had these really terrible stories about her ex-husband. You did Death of a Ladies Man with him. It's an album that a lot of people will talk to you about because they can put a handle on that one. They might miss out on You Came for the Old Ceremony or Reese's right. Songs or whatever, but they'll hone in on Death of a Ladies Man because of the Phil Spector stories that go with right. it. Do you look upon it as a sort of an interesting experiment that sort of gets a thumb sideways as opposed to a thumbs up or a thumbs down, that it could have maybe been better without Phil Spector?
Well, it could have been better without Leonard Cohen. You know, I think that the
track... Well, it was with that Leonard Cohen at the end, wasn't it?
More or less, yeah. But I mean, at a certain point, I even suggested to Phil, I think, that he's singing. He's a good singer, Phil, incidentally. Nobody knows that. But I felt it took a different kind of singer, a more powerful singer. I think I could do it now. I think it could handle it now. But I think that record would have been a great record without Leonard Cohen. I think if it had had Bill Medley on it or... you know, one of the Righteous Brothers or something like that, that or Aaron Neville, let's say, today, that or kind of voice.
You could give
him
a wall of sand. And
sometimes, yeah, somebody who could really, you know, climb that wall and walk on it, like the China Wall, and rejoice on top of that wall. It would have been a grand piece of work. As it was, I don't think I had the chops to meet it.
But at the same time, like, the circumstances were pretty strange. I mean, how crazy was the scene? Guns.
It was crazy as you can possibly imagine. I mean, it was crazier than I thought at the time. Looking back on it, I see that, you know, everybody was around the bend. I mean, Phil was around the bend, and I was around the bend for being there. You know, my own life was breaking up, and God knows what was happening to him because he was over the hill. You know, I mean, everybody was armed. I mean, you know, you'd slip on bullets. I mean, there were, you know, your hamburger was full of guns. I mean, you know, everywhere you turned, there was a gun. And, you know, and that would have been bad enough, but everybody was drunk, too, you know. And I remember Phil pulled a gun on the fiddle player, you know, in the song Fingerprints. And well, he was a country boy, and he just stood up and put his fiddle in the case and walked out. Mm-hmm. And Phil approached me with a bottle of Manischewitz red wine, and that's a kosher wine, sweet wine. You wouldn't want to drink it. I don't know what Phil was drinking it. And 45 in the other, put his arm around my shoulder and muzzled the gun into my neck and said, "I love you, Leonard." You know, I said, "I hope you do, Phil." I never understood this chopping up of time into decades, and I suppose, you know, it affords journalists and writers and sociologists a grand opportunity for, you know, sounding off on their own theories. And of course, things change, but I always thought I was just, you know, on the front line of my own life, just struggling away, trying to do one thing or another without any grand strategy, you know, just dodging the shrapnel. It's always seemed the same to me, to tell you the truth. Now, of course, things change, but I can't see for a man in his life that much changes.
Right, but by the same token, then, just let's talk about one's environment or whatever else is in one's life. In other words, like, you will actually say things on the album that you think that people will actually look back at some dreadful things, like, for instance, the Berlin Wall, right, like, for instance, Hiroshima, and say, hey, they were the good days. Is it that bad, the future?
Well, I don't know. I get a lot of resistance to that line. I've seen the future, baby. It is murder. Mm. You know, I got a lot of resistance to it in Europe. In the United States, the journalists I've spoken to, you know, not a raised eyebrow in the whole bunch. You know, over here where there's like full-fledged war raging about a half a mile down the road, you know, slaughtering going on all over the place, you know, people being attacked in their homes and shelters being burnt down, you know, famine down the street. Over here, like, it's, I have said something that really shouldn't be said. Well, the future's here. It is murder. So it's also, you know, a certain insanely cheerful tone to the record. If I just, you know, nailed that lyric up on the church door like Martin Luther or something, it might sound pretty grim, but it's you know, it's attached to a pretty hot little dance track. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the words dissolve into the music, and the music dissolves into the words. You just got, you know, energy, just energy for that apocalyptic dance through the apocalypse. But yeah, I think it is pretty grim. I think somehow the social contract between people has frayed or deteriorated or dissolved. And I think there is a return to tribalism. I think that the voices of the extreme have taken the glamour and the allure, and the center can no longer defend itself, can't mount a rhetoric that is inspiring. And I think people are more and more willing to defend their turf with homicide. Mm.
Okay, well, then that means that with what's happening in Bosnia, with what's happening in Germany, with this great freedom that was supposed to have come with the wall breaking down as though it was going to just happen overnight without realizing the cost over decades that we're going to have to pay for something like that. But in America, in another song you have, which is Democracy, you say democracy has come into America, which is ironic when you hear it, one, like, say, once or twice. Yeah. But after that, is it because you're saying that because of the sort of ethnic and cultural differences in America, that it is actually real democracy and it is actually trying to get itself together?
Well, I think that the song, you know, transcends the obvious irony of the hook. Democracy has come to the USA. What do you mean there isn't any democracy there? Well, there isn't any democracy anywhere. America is as good an experiment in democracy as there is any place. And, you know, Europeans used to look, or until very recently, look very skeptically to America, you know, very ironic take on America, very superior take, I might say, about America, you know. But I think in America's been dealing, you know, over the past century with problems that Northern Europe, the Northern European industrial democracy are just starting to confront. The problem, you know, the conflict of races, the conflict of cultures, you know. In America, I mean, the confrontation of men and women is there. The confrontation of sexual orientation, gay against straight, is there. You know, there's all kinds of intense and urgent confrontations that are being faced up to in America that are just being, are just at the start of being recognized in Europe. So the laboratory of democracy that America really is, I think, deserves our goodwill and our affirmation and our blessings. And I think the song gets to that place. But it gets to that place in the style of a big city. You know, I mean, a big city is not a Sunday school. I mean, people are not continually going around, you know, affirming the divinity of man and the divine spark in all human beings, you know, and the sanctity of the individual. I mean, it's a little more cynical than that. So it has the style of a big city speech, but it says that it's not coming from above. It's not being imposed. It's not the domain of a particular administration or ideology. That this faith we call democracy, that this new faith that we call democracy has a chance in America, and it's coming from unexpected places, through a crack in the wall, through a hole in the air, imperial, mysterious, amorous array.
Well, do you therefore think that it is the religion of the West, and is that a bit of a sort of a serious put down, because we don't actually consider democracy to be what it in reality really is? In other words, that it's not necessarily as wonderful as we sometimes try and define it.
Well, I don't presume. It's just a shot at it. I don't presume to have got a handle on the whole thing. I don't think anybody can. But I think it probably is the religion of the West, and probably a great religion, because it affirms other religions, which religions don't tend to do. Mm-hmm. And a great culture because it affirms other cultures. I think it's just beginning. I think it is based on faith, based on a real appetite for fraternity and equality and justice. And I think we're just on the edge of it. I think we're just working it out. I mean, until very recently, we thought democracy was, you know, the masses were going to like Shakespeare and Mozart or something like that. That was our idea of democracy, you know. Well, it's not going to be that way, you know. It's going to be something we don't know, but it has its own, as I say, they're imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. It's something that nobody can resist. I say, like, it's like the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. You know, it's got implications. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the poor in heart, for they shall see God. And it's come through a crack in the wall. It's coming from our failure. It's coming from the recognition that human beings fail, that we have been expelled from paradise, that we got to put this scene together, that it implies imperfections, it implies failures, you know, and that somehow democracy is a space, a mental space, where we got the energy, where energy is released, sufficient energy to confront the imperfection of the human